The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Catrone is founder and president of the Platypus Affiliated Society. He is also the author of the rather infamous essay, Why Not Trump? And today, he is a guest on this week's Zero Books podcast. It's Wednesday, May 31st, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're in New York City, you should turn up for the Left Forum. Zero Books will be hosting two panels. The first is entitled Capitalism Gets Knocked Down, But Then Gets Up Again, and that will feature our author, Michael Roberts. That's on June 3rd from noon until 1:50. And the second panel is entitled Kill All Normies. That's, of course, Angela Nagel's panel. And that is scheduled for Sunday, June 4th from 3:40 till 5:40. These panels will be featured as audio podcasts in upcoming episodes. But if you're a Zero Books Club member, you should know that the next Inside Zero Books podcast will be delayed, possibly for a week. The music you're listening to right now is a soundtrack from Chris Catrone's movie entitled Movie, which you can find at archive.org. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Catrone trying to reframe Trump. Chris Catrone is a professor of art history at the University of Chicago. He is one of the founders of the contrarian leftist organization Platypus. He often calls himself the last Marxist, and he requests that we think of him as our political track coach. He is the author of the essay Why Not Trump, which was published in the Platypus Review. And I'm glad to have a chance to talk to him today. Chris Catrone, thank you for taking the time to be on the Zero Books podcast.
Thank you. One correction. So I'm at the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. The University of Chicago is where I teach social science, and that's just a sideline.
Are you an artist as well as an art historian?
Yes. I have a background now, a while ago, as a practicing artist. I was a video artist and had a little exhibition career for a number of years before I went back to get my PhD.
Huh. Can we see any of that work online since it was video?
It's on archive.org. I have a few of the works up there.
Mm-hmm. Oh, great. I'll have to look for that. So now you're also one of the founders of the Platypus Affiliated Society, which, like a lot of other Marxist groups, it's been hounded by controversy and accused of, you know, a multitude of deviations. The slogan of the Platypus Affiliated Society is "The left is dead, long live the left." Could you explain what that slogan means to you?
When we started out, which is a while ago now, back in 2006 is when we started our reading group, and then we didn't formalize the organization until 2007. But 2006 is when we issued our first statements. And it was in the context of the Iraq anti-war movement. There was in the air at the time, for instance, here in Chicago, they had the first convention of the New Students for a Democratic Society, the New SDS. And so there was a kind of reconfiguration in the air. And at the time, the New SDS was counseled by the old SDS that had formed itself into the Movement for a Democratic Society. They were the mentors of the New SDS, and they encouraged the New SDS not to follow the example of the 1960s. They were very upfront about it. People like Carl Davidson, Mark Rudd, Carl Oglesby, stalwarts of the old New Left from the 60s, they said, look, don't make the same mistakes that we made. Don't take anything for granted. So it was in that atmosphere that we made that statement, the left is dead, long live the left, meaning that it was an opportunity to really reconsider things at a fundamental level and not take anything for granted.
So do you think at that moment the left that had died was the new left from the 60s?
If you look at our founding statements, we talk about sort of three phases of the death of the left. One is Stalinism in the 1920s and 1930s. The other is the new left, the 1960s and 70s. And then finally, the post-political left of the 1980s and 1990s. That these three phases really, for us, liquidated not only the program and the theory, but also the intention and the goal, the animating spirit of the Marxist left that had existed prior to that, prior to the 20th century, really. So we looked at it in terms of the bad inheritance, the legacy that, as Marx put it in the 18th Brumaire, weighed on the brains of the living like a nightmare. And we saw that as the old left of the 1930s, Stalinism, and the new left of the 1960s, that the left today we found to be transfixed by those failures and really stuck in those moments in the combined legacy of the 30s and the 60s in particular.
I'm interested in the post-political left of the 80s and 90s. I think the reason why is because, you know, I'm 46, so that would be the left I grew up in, right? So I feel like I sort of understand just intuitively what you mean by calling that the post-political left. But can you unpack that a little?
Right. Why was that post-political? This would be the kind of post-new left, meaning I feel like, you know, you and I, our generation, we were really schooled by the new left. I came of age as a leftist as a teenager, and the people I immediately encountered were all veterans of the 60s and 70s, new left. Mm-hmm. And they had a much reduced perspective on what was possible. They were really shocked by the Reagan and Thatcher revolution. They were very pessimistic and had much lower horizons and had retreated. The so-called Maoist, the Maoist so-called march through the institutions. They had joined academia. They had joined the established labor movement. They had sort of ensconced themselves and had taken this long, long march perspective, but then they got lost in that perspective. Basically, I went to a very lefty college. I went to Hampshire College. Mm-hmm. And my professors there said the same thing that the activists I encountered as a high school student were telling me. You know, I ran into, you know, I grew up in New York, so I went to the anarchist bookstore in Manhattan. I went and asked them about Marxism, and out of the back room came Murray Bookchin, who immediately chastised me for being interested in Marxism.
And you managed to go on and read Marx after being told not to by Murray Bookchin? That wasn't enough to stop you?
Yeah, I had already read Marx, so I already knew that he was kind of full of shit.
Okay.
And I hadn't read his Listen, Marxist, which I read much later. And actually, I appreciate what he says in that polemical pamphlet from 1969. I appreciate a lot of it. Of his critique of Marxism. However, you know, again, you know, I felt like I came of age in a time when people were giving up the political project, even of the new left, as limited as it had been. So I was involved in Central American Solidarity in the 1980s. That was my first form of leftist activism. And it was mostly in the context of, I grew up on Long Island, so it was in the context of Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, but also the Catholic Church, the Catholic left. And for instance, the Catholic Church on Long Island, they gave shelter to a lot of refugees from Central America, political refugees from Central America. So I actually had an opportunity to meet and talk to people who were from the FMLN in El Salvador. And they said, look, you know, there's never going to be socialism. We're not really fighting for revolution in El Salvador. What we're fighting for is to put pressure on the U.S. Congress to oppose Reagan's support for the regime and what we want. We don't really want a civil war. We don't want to take power because we saw what happened in Vietnam. We don't want that to happen to our country. And I said, well, what about socialism in the United States? And they said, look, the American working class voted for Reagan. There's never going to be any socialism in the United States. Mm-hmm. So they said, look, socialism is a no-go, not in El Salvador, not in the United States. You know, they said, look, Fidel Castro tells us not to take power because look at what Cuba has had to suffer. And this was shocking to me because I thought, well, you know, these are leftists. These are revolutionaries. These are people fighting who have taken up the gun and are fighting. And they're telling me, look, you know, we don't want revolution. We don't think socialism is possible.
So you can take up weapons and still not want a revolution.
Exactly. It's what Lenin called a long time ago, reformism with guns.
Right. Yeah. So how did we end up in this? I mean, in this position in the 80s, what had failed? I guess it was Reagan, right, that came along and made the new left even look like it was too ambitious.
That's right. And certainly by the 90s, you know, I myself became depoliticized for a while by two events that took place in 1992, namely the LA riots and the election of Bill Clinton.
Yeah.
They were both extremely discouraging to me because as sympathetic as I was at the outrage at the Rodney King verdict that exonerated the police who beat Rodney King, people that I knew on the left were calling the riots a rebellion. They were calling it political in a way that, you know, they were comparing it to the riots of the 60s. And I just thought, no, this is completely different because it has no political prospects. It has no, you know, it's not in the context of a movement like the civil rights movement or Black Power. And then when Bill Clinton was elected, you know, I went to this very lefty school. I was still in college at Hampshire College. And all these, you know, professors and students who called themselves leftists, Marxists, anarchists, they were enraptured by the election of Bill Clinton. And so I thought, okay, if the future belongs to the LA riots and to Bill Clinton, then I'm quitting the left. And I did for more than 10 years.
Well, I'll tell you a little bit of my bio, not that it's that interesting, but it's sort of a parallel. I was a college dropout in 92. So I was working for a PERG, you know, the PERGs. I was working for Osberg in Oregon here, and
we had Mossberg in New York, in Massachusetts, and we had Nyberg in New York.
Yeah, and funnily enough, last night I went and had drinks with a guy I hadn't seen in 9 years who I used to really know well back then in like 91, 92. And we're talking about the PERGs, and what he said was that there was a huge difference in the PERGs between the people that were doing what you and I were doing, which was we were going door to door begging for checks, basically. And said, and we were doing that for a living, you know, as scroungy as it was, you know, as D-class A as it was for me. But it was something we were doing for a living. And then there was the students, and the students would come in the summer. They were okay because they were also doing the work. And then there were also the student organizers, people you'd only see at retreats and things like that. And they were pretty awful. So it seemed like there was a class division on the left. I mean, we're just sort of talking about inside the left, there's this big class division. So do you think that was one of the reasons why the left became depoliticized at that time? Was that became professionalized? Or
it's possible that fed into it. I mean, again, the institutionalization of the left. So, for instance, when I was doing activism in the 80s, Central American Solidarity, you know, I went to a lot of demonstrations, a lot of protest demos, and obviously protest demos had been institutionalized as a form. So I was shocked by the fact that there was ritualized, coordinated with the police, sort of mock arrests. I mean, they were real arrests, but they were essentially mock arrests, that there was a kind of ritualization of civil disobedience that seemed to be the exact opposite of what the civil rights movement did.
Right.
Because it was, you know, pre-scripted with the police. And, you know, that has changed in the meantime because around the Iraq anti-war movement, for example, I was shocked at how violent the police were towards the illustrators. And it did seem like between the time that I was first active in the late 80s and early 90s and in the early 2000s, that the right to protest had actually been undermined. And so the kind of ritualized protest demonstration culture had taken a different tack in the meantime. And you see that now with like black bloc tactics and this kind of thing. But still, the idea that politics amounts to a protest demonstration, in other words, just registering your protest, just making your complaint heard, without actually having any perspective on any real change happening. So there certainly are organizations where this is what people do for a living. They organize demos. And they're essentially, more or less, I think, not only just trying to put pressure on the Democratic Party, because I saw that in the 80s, but in fact, they're not even really a pressure tactic on the Democratic Party. They just are the Democratic Party. They just are part of what's called the nonprofit industrial complex, the NGOs. And so I see NGO leftism as definitely post-political in that sense, meaning that the left no longer exists separately as a political entity, but is just part of the kind of constituency group organizing for the Democratic Party.
I know people who did think, I've heard from people at the time, I knew people who thought this way, and then I was surprised that 20 years later, I was still hearing from people who thought that the Rodney King riots would have developed or should have developed into something real, some real rebellion, real political movement, but that the problem was too many Marxists, white Marxists, were critical and didn't see the potential and weren't supportive enough.
Which seems odd to me.
It is an odd explanation. I mean, at the time, I can say I was a youth member of the Spartacist League. I was a Trotskyist in college at the time of the LA riots. And what we experienced in the five colleges, of which Hampshire was a part, was a series or really a rash, like a simultaneous campus takeovers by black student organizations, both at my school and at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, and as well as around the country. Right. And I participated. In other words, I, you know, participated in the takeovers. Mm-hmm. And what shocked me at the time, because I thought, okay, the riots are one thing, but maybe a movement could come out of it. And what shocked me at the time, however, was just how limited the aspirations were, meaning that I thought that the campus takeovers happening around the country in response to the verdict exonerating the police in the Rodney King case, I thought that that could be, you know, the beginnings of a movement. But what shocked me was how the students engaged in the takeover were really only concerned with making demands of their local schools.
And that same thing seems to be going on now, in a way, with Black Lives Matter.
Exactly. Except even in some ways less. I mean, the sad thing about Black Lives Matter, I mean, I remarked upon this to my friends at the time. The Rodney King case, he was beaten. He was beaten really badly, but he wasn't killed. And I just feel like now, right, like the police are much more violent, actually, and it takes a lot more violence by the police to generate a movement.
Right.
And you know, just the shocking recognition. It's not as if people, you know, police killed people back then, too, of course.
Right.
But, you know, it took a lot less to generate protest. Whereas now, it's hard to sustain a protest movement, even in the face of, you know, not one or two, but dozens and dozens of videotaped police killings.
Day after day, it seems like.
Day. And you know, the other thing that's shocking, of course, is that it's not as if that police killing people hasn't continued, but Black Lives Matter has disappeared. And so to my mind, it had to do with the fact that there was a black president and a black attorney general. And so there was the idea that they could get a hearing. Whereas obviously with Trump has made it clear that he's on the side of the police and that he's, you know, I mean, he did make some statements during the campaign, regretting, you know, the death of innocent people at the hands of the police. But he's also made it clear that they're not going to get a hearing from him the way they might have expected a hearing from the Obama administration.
Okay, well, I want to do the second part of that question about the Rodney King riots, which is that it seems to me that when a leftist says the reason those riots didn't take root and grow into a real movement for political change is because of the Marxist left not understanding and supporting it enough. When they say it seems like we have a grandiose vision of our own role in history. And it seems, I'm wondering if the Platypus Affiliated Society might have a similar grandiose self-estimation. I mean, because it seems like there's a lot of emphasis on the failures of the left, as if the left is what drives history. Am I misreading Platypus, or does the left drive history more than I realize?
Well, of course, that's a complex question because it has two aspects. In other words, one aspect would be the degree to which there has been any historical progress whatsoever in the modern era. I think that one could make the point that it's been driven by the left. In other words, you know, from the American Revolution, the French Revolution, the socialist movement of the 19th century, the revolutions after World War I, obviously a great deal of historical change has been driven by the left in that period. What's less clear, of course, is the degree to which the left has played any role in historical progress since World War I, essentially, since the 1920s. More so, whether there's been any historical progress whatsoever since the 1920s. That would be the more controversial claim. And so, of course, to say that the left plays some superordinate role in history today is absurd, and that's why we say the left is dead. Because, of course, the left plays no role whatsoever. So what we're talking about is, you know, how do we understand historical progress and how do we understand the role of the left? Now, Platypus, you know, we actually have a very limited and modest project, which is to say that we are left-centric, not only in the historical sense, but also in terms of the present, because we think that the left doesn't really do anything. But one thing that it does do is miseducate people and provide, in however limited a way, an obstacle, actually, to a true left forming. That, you know, these left organizations that have been around since the 60s and 70s, you know, the International Socialist Organization, the Marxist Humanists, the Spartacists, you know, the RCP, they've done really nothing in the past 40 years except miseducate people and be a revolving door of young people who end up as Democrats. It doesn't affect a hell of a lot of people, but it does do a little bit of harm. And it's also an opportunity for clarification. Like I said, when we started out in 2006, there seemed to be a more general atmosphere of reconsideration that has since collapsed. But when we started out, there did seem to be a window of opportunity in which nothing was going to be taken for granted, things could be reconsidered, and in which specifically the failures of the new left could be criticized.
Now, when do you think that collapsed?
It collapsed in phases, of course. But it, you know, the Obama election was obviously a major collapse because a lot of the left that had grown up under George W. Bush ended up feeding into the Obama campaign.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, the one little, what I call the cry of protest before accommodation, Occupy Wall Street in 2011, before Obama's re-election in 2012. I think that was another moment in which people were registering their disappointment with Obama, but ultimately they reconciled to him, to his re-election in 2012. And so, you know, what you have really since then is people retreating to the old verities. In other words, they just, you know, are not reconsidering anything. They're just sticking to their guns, so to speak. You know, their kind of received wisdom of leftism. And of course, that played out with the election last year in 2016.
Right. Well.
So, okay, so now we'll get to the real meat of our conversation, which is that the Platypus Affiliated Society stance towards Trump seems, well, it's extremely controversial. And I think of it as being accelerationist, maybe, but others would just say, yeah, the Platypus Affiliated Society is crypto-fascist. You know, they're actually a right-wing organization, and they support Trump.
Well, first of all, of course, Platypus didn't support Trump. You know, I didn't support Trump. I mean, there's nothing to support about Trump.
Right.
What there is, however, is a very important opportunity to criticize how the left has lined up behind the Democrats. And they haven't done so completely and totally. In other words, there's actually a fair amount of circumspection around the Trump election by, for instance, old new leftists like Tariq Ali, who refuses to say that Trump is worse than Hillary would have been, in fact. Mm-hmm. You do see that a great deal. But, okay, let's take the, you know, the premise of your question head on, which is to say that, that somehow Trump is a fascist, that to say that, you know, I wrote an article commissioned by Platypus because Platypus wanted an article to have at the beginning of the school year before the election in September 2016. And so I thought, okay, you know, I'll write something that's short enough to be handed out as a flyer. And, you know, to get a conversation with students going around the election, and that's the Why Not Trump article.
Right.
And, you know, that article was not an endorsement of Trump, but basically saying, look, everything that Trump is calling for is probably going to happen anyway, has been happening, it will happen, except maybe detente with Russia wouldn't happen under Hillary. You know, why not? And especially because... you know, after 8 years of the Democrats and 8 years of Obama, it was very likely that people who had voted for Obama would switch and vote for Trump. You know, I saw that coming. And so what to me was remarkable and important was the hysteria around Trump and how much of an obstacle that was and how much that involved what I called the mendacity of the status quo. Meaning that to paint Trump as a fascist, especially, you know, growing up in New York, I'm very, very well aware of that, you know, what Trump really is. And what he is a conservative Democrat. So I think that one of my articles, I pointed out how if you really wanted an analog to Trump, it would be Ed Koch, the mayor of New York in the 1980s, who was... a law and order conservative Democrat, but was, you know, in favor of kind of social liberalism, like gay rights, etc. But was a very hardcore law and order guy. And that's the consistent conservative right-wing character of Trump, is that he's a law and order guy. Pretty much everything right-wing about Trump comes from that. His immigration stance, his anti-terrorism, he's a law and order guy. Which is, of course, execrable, and, you know, I hated Ed Koch, and I hate this law and order bullshit that we have to deal with Trump, but that's what it is. It's not fascism. It's not fascism. And the confusion there, and really the misrepresentation there, especially by anyone on the left who's calling Trump a fascist, to elide the difference between law and order and fascism, is to neglect, for example, that fascism was insurrectionary. In other words, fascism aimed to overthrow the state. Fascism was revolutionary in its own conception. In other words, the neo-Nazi right in the United States wants to overthrow the government.
Right.
The actual fascists want to overthrow the government. That has nothing to do with Trump or his support.
Well, let me just push back a little bit on that, because I don't think I totally disagree with you, actually, but I there are just a couple of things that what you're describing leaves out. The one part of what you leave out is the character of Trump as a personality, the perception of him as being incompetent, sort of a Mickey Mouse candidate, and also the way that that Mickey Mouse candidate was embraced by actual fascist movements in our culture. Not real political movements, but cultural movements. So you I mean the alt-right, yeah. But, I mean, it's not just, you know, the alt-right is a blanket term, but there are a lot of different...
Yeah, I don't really know much about the alt-right. I would also, you know, like a kind of a Richard Spencer character, I guess, these kind of race realist, white nationalist people. Like, that's one thing. But then there's the alt-right, which is Breitbart, which is, you know, Steve Bannon, which is something completely different. Because, of course, Steve Bannon is not a race realist or a white nationalist.
Well, I think it's – he may not be a white nationalist, but he may very well be a race realist. You don't really know, right? I mean, there are – race realism with Charles Murray pushing it is something that has can be taken up by people who don't overtly consider themselves to be actually fascist, right? So – but yeah. Yeah. So there's – I think it the Bannon, Milo Yiannopoulos, Gavin McInnes – types of hyper-masculinist, anti-feminist, anti-social justice warrior right bleeds into the alt-right. It doesn't into Richard Spencer territory. There's not a clear division, and that's intentional on the part of the alt-right.
You know, so there's
sure that they, that they kind of slam their way into things, of course.
Right.
I just, you know.
But the point is that the last point with that was that and some people, and I don't think it was too small a number, especially amongst the non-college educated working class, voted for Trump as an insurrectionary kind of gesture because they didn't think he would do a good job, because they were going to send a Mickey Mouse candidate into the White House. You know, there was a, as Michael Moore said, you know, just holding a big middle finger to the establishment to put Trump into the White House. So even though he doesn't represent a fascist politics, his ascendancy is powered by this movement that is.
Well, you know, I think that we heard this once before, namely when Reagan was elected. And, you know, even my former comrades, the Spartacist League, called Reagan the favored candidate.
Uh-huh.
Right? And I just think that this is wrong. I think this is really highly mistaken, and it just ends up alibiing the Democrats. Because I think that this kind of chain of association idea, this kind of paranoid reasoning, really, which is to say that Trump opens the door to worse, I really don't think that that's the case. In other words, we didn't see after Reagan, we didn't see the country become more right wing in the direction of, you know, racism, et cetera, et cetera. What you saw was rather George Herbert Walker Bush, you know, the kinder, gentler conservatism. You actually saw a kind of moderation, and you saw a reorientation of the center. You didn't see everything drifting to the right in terms of the cultural politics. In terms of socioeconomics, that's an entirely different matter. But in terms of the cultural politics, it's not as if Reagan opened the door towards a deepening racism in the United States. No, not at all.
Yeah.
Right? But he was seen, right? Because he was seen as the antithesis to the new left, that they just attributed to him everything that they opposed. In other words, because he was a shock again. And so what we have to avoid is the idea that somehow Trump is the anti-Obama.
Right. It sure does seem like that's true in just personality and public perception, that he is the opposite of Obama. That seems, but he's not in terms of policy.
Right.
You know, but, yeah.
Right. And including what we would call cultural policy, meaning I think at the end of the day, what Trump is going to push through in terms of immigration reform is going to be exactly what Obama was trying to do for 8 years. In other words, a guest worker program, a more draconian regime in terms of the border and deportations, you know, it's going to be the exact same policy that Obama and George W. Bush tried to implement.
Hey, great. Okay. So now we'll be able to record to the end, hopefully, without any more difficulty. Great. So the last thing we were talking about was how, in some ways, Trump will be continuing Obama's policies. And I think that's a very controversial claim in some, you know, for some people, but obviously there's a lot of truth to it. But that's only to the extent that Trump will be able to pass any kind of policies at all. And so I guess I want to return to this notion that Trump's ascendancy, his success, did represent a major, seemingly radical break from the way we think politics would run under, you know, in the by the status quo. You know, that was not a normal election season that we just went through. The people who should have been running didn't end up running on the Republican side, either Marco Rubio or Jeb Bush. And we just had this clown candidate come and just wreck the process. That's what it seemed like, from the establishment point of view.
Well, we didn't only have that. We also had Bernie Sanders. And, you know, again, how plausible was Bernie Sanders as a candidate? You know, I'm not sure. I mean, obviously, he's more respectable than Trump, but that also might have negatively affected him. In other words, he might have limited his appeal by conforming too much to the Democratic Party mold. Now, what you said earlier, I want to sort of push on a little bit, which is to say that somehow people thought that Trump would be a kind of disaster for the system. In other words, that they wanted him to just wreck the system because he's incompetent.
Uh-huh.
Right? I don't think that that's the case. You know, I know a lot of people who voted for Trump, who are, you know, sort of run the gamut in terms of socioeconomically, culturally. I know Muslims who voted for Trump, Latinos who voted for Trump, Black people who voted for Trump, women who voted for Trump, middle-class people who voted for Trump, working-class people who voted for Trump. I know gay people, straight people who voted for Trump. And no one who voted for Trump that I know wanted him to make it impossible to govern. In fact, it was the exact opposite, which is to say that they voted for him because they wanted an end to the gridlock. And they thought that with Hillary and with the Republicans in Congress, it would just be a continuation of what we had under Obama, which is to say a total stalemate. It wasn't a fuck you gesture by any means. And also they remained skeptical of him as a personality. You know, in other words, they were skeptical of the messenger, but they actually liked the message. And also they weren't particularly anti-immigrant or anything else or, you know, culturally, socially conservative. But that could just be my, you know, bias, my sample bias of the people that I knew.
Yeah, right.
But, you know, I think that, for instance, I knew a great number of people, including my family, who voted twice for Obama and then voted for Trump.
Right.
And that's the bottom line. In other words, the kooky right always votes for the Republicans.
Yeah.
Right. So that's not what's remarkable here. What's remarkable is rather the swing voters.
Yeah, and they're in the Rust Belt is the ones that I would think are the most remarkable and most worthy of being examined.
And I don't think that they voted to make the government dysfunctional. I think that they voted to make the government overcome its dysfunction after 8 years of gridlock.
They thought that Trump could do that.
Sure, and Trump himself has always said that he would have to overcome resistance from the Republicans and look forward to working with the Democrats.
Right.
He said that many times. And he continues to say that, for instance, around the healthcare stuff. You know, he says that, you know, he would rather jettison the Freedom Caucus and get the Democrats on board. Which, by the way, you know, is not, you know, like the healthcare stuff, like whether it's Obamacare or Trump, you know, of course, from my perspective, this has nothing to do with people getting better healthcare. It has to do with the government saving money on Medicare and Medicaid, which I'm completely unsympathetic to. Right. So Obama, you know, Obamacare was the healthcare crisis. The so-called healthcare crisis is not because people aren't getting healthcare. The healthcare crisis is because the government can't afford to pay what it pays for Medicare and Medicaid. And so I'm completely unsympathetic to all of it, whether it was Hillary's proposal back in 1993 or Obama or now Trump. You know, it's all, as far as I'm concerned, just about capitalist austerity.
Yeah, so, but we do have Sanders out there trying to push a single payer bill right now, and
we might get single payer. In other words, if you heard what Charles Krautheimer said, his analysis—he's the conservative, you know, pundit—he said that he, looking at the way Trump was handling things, he thought that actually what was going to happen was that Trump would ultimately give us single payer. And again, why is that, right? Because if we ever do get single payer, it's because it's going to be an austerity measure. In other words, if we ever get single payer, it's going to be because they decide that it will cost less.
How could getting everyone onto a Medicare for all system cost less than not having everyone on Medicare and Medicaid?
It could easily end up costing less, especially if, as Trump put it, he wants to renegotiate things like drug prices. Yeah. I mean, the whole thing is driven by, considered false logic. It's budgetary. It's not really about providing people with health care, although we should also observe that during the debates with the Republicans, Trump said that unlike his fellow Republicans, he was unwilling to let people die on the street. So, you know, again, you know, what we're talking about is a realignment at the center of U.S. politics that's coming out of the crisis of the two parties. You know, this is something the mainstream commentators observed in 2014. They wondered whether it would be possible to maintain the Obama coalition of voters, that they were skeptical that Hillary would be able to reproduce Obama's electorate. That, combined with the fact that usually after 8 years, the party in the White House changes anyway, you know, I think is what gave us Trump. Because I don't think any other Republican candidate would have won against Hillary. And I also think the weakness of the Democrats was demonstrated by their inability to stop Sanders sooner than they did. They ultimately stopped Sanders, but you know that they would have much preferred him be stopped much earlier.
Well, see, the way I look at it is the weakness of the left was demonstrated by us failing to get Sanders the nomination. That there wasn't enough populist energy behind Sanders to really get him all the way, whereas the far-right populist energy behind Trump did get him the nomination. That the right, the radical right, was more powerful in that moment than the radical left.
Yeah, I would be skeptical of that because I'm not sure what kind of clout the radical right really has, certainly in terms of voter turnout. Now, the left, of course, has no possibility with respect to that either. Now, Sanders, what would have allowed Sanders to get the nomination would have been if the established Democrat constituencies switched over to him. So he didn't have much organized labor support, for example, Sanders. What's remarkable is how well Sanders did without those kinds of constituency and community organization-based support that the Democrats are based on. So,
what do you think? What explains that?
What explains his inability to get them?
No, what explains his ability to do okay? You know, almost with getting within spitting distance of the nomination without them.
Well, it's what the Democratic Party establishment said, which is that he got the votes of a lot of non-Democrats anyway, meaning he got a lot of independent voters. and a lot of young people who the Democratic establishment considers to be naive. In other words, you got a lot of first-time voters and a lot of independent voters, i.e. people who are not real Democrats. And of course, they could say that about Sanders himself, that he wasn't a real Democrat. Well, guess what? Trump's not a real Republican either.
Right, that's what I'm saying. I mean,
he's not a real Republican because somehow he's a fascist. Any more than Sanders not being a real Democrat means that he's a socialist. See, I know Bernie Sanders for a long time, too. He was up in Vermont when I was at Hampshire. And Sanders is not much of a socialist. He's not a fringe leftist. He's much closer to a kind of Ralph Nader. Like, if you look at, you know, his kind of quixotic speeches that he would make in Congress, it would be very much along the lines of consumer advocacy type issues. It wasn't driven by any kind of hardcore leftist or let alone socialist program or policy. It was just a kind of liberalism. And that was the appeal, right? That was the appeal. In other words, I think that Sanders got a lot of appeal from centrist voters.
Right. And so did Trump.
That's right. So what we're talking about is the crisis at the center, meaning the Republicans, the established Republicans and established Democrats lost support at the center, and that support got picked up by Sanders and Trump. So it has nothing to do with the radical right or the radical left, to my mind.
So what does that mean? What is that center? Just like the middle class, white middle class vote? Is that what we're talking about?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say just white. Because as we know, Trump got better minority representation in the vote than any Republican candidate in the last 20 years.
Right.
He also did better among women. And so I wouldn't just say, you know, white, but I would say, you know, middle class is this kind of funny category in the United States because everybody's middle class, nobody's middle class. Platypus put a forum on down at the University of Chicago during Black Lives Matter called Black Politics and State Violence, in which we had a couple of you know, good speakers, Michael Dawson, who's a former black nationalist, and Mel Rothenberg, who's a former Maoist. And they both agreed. They said, in the black community, if you have a job, you're middle class. Yeah, which I thought was like one of these shocking new leftisms that I hate. Right. And what they meant by that was, if you have a job, you're conservative.
Huh.
Yeah. You're middle class, meaning you're conservative. And, you know, I'm sure the degree to which, so again, this middle class category, I'm sure the degree to which Trump got minority voters, I'm sure it was working class from my perspective, working class, but maybe from a different perspective, middle class. You know, because certainly the actual middle class minority voters are just Democrats, right? They're part of the professional managerial class. They're part of the established Democratic Party community, ethnic constituency machines, you know, the churches. They definitely voted for Hillary.
Right.
They didn't vote for Trump. But the kind of more atomized wage earner working class, yeah, those are the people who are up for grabs.
Okay, so now let me ask you this. I mean, I feel like I'm not quite sold on your vision here, but it certainly is more compelling than maybe some people would think, right? So I want to explore it a little bit more. Oh, now I've lost my question. The question I guess I have is, why did Trump get this huge reaction then? Other than, was it just his character, just his personality, just the way he appeared culturally that made people become hysterical in response to him? Especially, let's say, on the far left? Because one of the things I've noticed lately is that the people who are most dedicated to being outright Marxist are most likely to be embracing the center of the Democratic Party right now, the Clinton you know, of the world. And the people who are more reformist in their leftism, people who might have really gotten behind Bernie Sanders early on, the people who are think of socialism as, you know, the New Deal, they're more likely to be really angry at the center of the Democratic Party and to really not be less afraid of Trump.
I mean, it cuts across these things. I mean, this is where I think that, you know, change at the center, crisis at the center, change at the center. It also means that the historical ways in which ideology and the electorate have been divided up, I think, are up for grabs now. And so I do think that, you know, what you have with Hillary and with the Democratic Party more generally is the McGovernite Democratic Party. In other words, the Democratic Party, as it tried to absorb the new left, and of course got on board with neoliberalism, and neoliberalism as a policy of multicultural austerity, essentially, that you saw in the Clinton era of the 90s. And which was facilitated, of course, back then by the fact that there was a boom, meaning a lot of the reorientation of capitalism and of state policy was facilitated by prosperity in the 90s. You know, it didn't play quite as well now with Hillary, with part two, with Clinton two, that there was a crisis. In other words, the 2008 crisis is real. And regardless of what governments might want to do, changes are going to occur in global capitalism. There already is a slowdown of international trade. There's already a reorientation going on. There was an article that talked about how, you know, the vaunted transnational corporations that people blame for neoliberalism actually play far less of a role economically in the world than they once did. And of course, that had to do with, you know, the idea that somehow it was transnationals versus national sovereignty. And what people didn't realize is that these so-called transnational corporations were actually creatures of Fordism. They were creatures of the Fordist state during the Cold War. They're really creations of the Cold War. And that, of course, they've become less important as the global economy has shifted, especially with regard to the developing world. And, you know, that, again, posing it as corporations versus nation states was a mistaken way of thinking about neoliberalism to begin with. And again, now the idea that somehow it's globalism versus national sovereignty, it's not that at all. Meaning, you know, Trump is not going to just be a protectionist or anti-trade or something like that. But the specific configuration of capitalist firms and state policies, that is going to change. And so the way that I like to address this is not like neoliberalism and anti-neoliberalism, which is where you get this populism stuff, people calling Trump a populist or people calling Sanders a populist. I think it's a mistake because it makes it seem like it's global elites versus populism. Well, no, what it is neoliberal politics and neoliberal policies that have become antiquated, especially after the 2008 crisis, and that what we're going to have now is post-neoliberalism. It's not going to be anti-neoliberalism. It's going to be post-neoliberalism, meaning there's going to be a great deal of continuity, but there is going to be change. I think it's always difficult for people to think both of those things at once, continuity and change. Meaning, in many respects, Trump is, of course, going to be a neoliberal, but there is going to be some change. And by the way, that change would have happened even under Hillary. It just wouldn't have been announced in quite the same way. It wouldn't have had the accompanying rhetoric. And it wouldn't have had the ideological shift.
Right?
And again, it's how we understand that ideological shift. The hysteric response is that, you know, people were very upset with neoliberalism all these years. But now that it's under threat, people are going to become the defenders of neoliberalism after it's already gone, after it's already passed into history.
Right.
And, you know, this is what we're dealing with, and it's why people had to call Trump a fascist. So my old mentor, Adolf Reed, right?
Yeah.
For instance, I think that he had a very bad moment around this election. So he was a supporter of Bernie Sanders. But then when it came down to Hillary versus Trump, he endorsed Hillary, of course. And he even said that people's reluctance to vote for Hillary was due to sexism. Even though he himself, Adolf Reed, is the greatest Marxist critic of identity politics as neoliberalism. Even he fell for the neoliberalism in the end. Right? And we had some members of Platypus who showed up at one of his talks at the University of Chicago, and they asked him, you know, questions about Trump. And he said, well, I hope you're happy in the concentration camp that's waiting for you under Trump.
Wow.
And I just feel like this is absurd. You know, there's not going to be any concentration camp, not, certainly not for leftists, under Trump. And B, no, people did not fail to vote for Hillary because they were sexist. No, that's not what happened.
Right. Well, I mean, it probably did happen, but that would have happened. You know, they wouldn't have voted for any Democrat anyway, those people. You know, so, yeah, they didn't want a woman president. They also didn't want a Democratic to be in office, and they weren't going to vote for Bernie Sanders or Michael Dukakis or Bill Clinton or any Democrat. And they didn't want women to be president. So I think that, you know, that happened. But, okay, so you still haven't explained to me why Marxists like Adolf Reed were more likely to embrace neoliberalism than some maybe like social democrat reformist.
And then, endorsed Hillary. And, you know, it makes sense, of course. I mean, from my perspective, you know, personally, as like a gay person living in a major city, working in academia, of course, it's in my personal self-interest that Hillary was elected.
How is that so? Just because do you think that Pence and Trump are more likely to go after some hard-won rights for gays, or is it because you're urban that it's in your interest economically? What do you mean?
Trump has to maintain his base, so he had to, you know, appoint a really right-wing guy to the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. I don't know that, you know, they're going to reverse gay marriage and things like that. I don't think that they really will, but, you know, they might. You know, he's had to throw all sorts of sops to the right. And as he said during the campaign, Trump said, look, I'm running as a Republican. Pardon me. He said, if I was running as a Democrat, I'd have to do things differently, but I'm running as a Republican. All right. And so, of course, that means, right, that there's going to be an opening for the Republican right under a Trump presidency, of course. Absolutely.
Yep.
And that's, you know, and again, at a cultural level, that's problematic, even though Trump himself is more socially liberal on these things. Still, he's going to, you know, potentially compromise them. And again, you know, like 8 years under Obama, I can tell you Chicago has been on the gravy train. You know, I was here under Clinton. I've lived in Chicago for almost 25 years. I lived here under Clinton. I lived here under George W. Bush. And I lived here under Obama. And I can tell you it's a lot better when a Democrat's in office, because they definitely funnel money to Chicago.
Okay, but while the gravy train's going, there's also
and academia, of course. I'm a professional academic, and academia does do better under the Democrats.
Okay, in academia, but not in Chicago as a whole, because
in Chicago as a whole, in neoliberal gentrified Chicago, which is of course where I live, meaning I don't live in the ghetto, of course not, right? You know, because no one who could get out would not get out.
Right. No, I'm not. So I'm just saying that. But it's worth noting that the crime rates in the in Chicago have been going up and up over the last couple of years, even as the gravy train is running.
And it's really shocking, of course, the way they handle policy in a place like Chicago. So, for instance, Rahm Emanuel, when he was running for mayor against Chuy Garcia here, you know, it came out that he had said, in private conversation with one of his black supporters, he said, there's no point in spending money on education for kids who are never going to have a job anyway.
right? And of course, that from a neoliberal perspective, of course, that's true. I also was shocked to learn that in the last few years, Chicago has paid out $500 million to victims of police brutality.
Wow.
So they're willing to, to crank down. And also the violence in Chicago, it's concentrated. There's gang violence in Chicago. And it's concentrated in certain neighborhoods. It's very concentrated violence. And so when the crime rate goes up in Chicago, it doesn't have the same character as the crime rate in New York City going down, because it's just a very different kind of city. And so the violence is really concentrated in certain communities due to gangs. It's, you know, there isn't, like, in New York, you have the broken windows type policing. Chicago, it's very different. In Chicago, it really is a question of whether poor communities are served by the police. And there's also a long history of complicity between the police and the gangs. So there's a lot of, like, really grubby, corrupt stuff in a place like Chicago. Chicago is more like Los Angeles. It's not like New York City. Neoliberal gentrified Chicago, which is actively casting off large portions of the city and condemning them to violence and utter poverty, right? That's what I mean when I say Chicago does better under the Democrats.